I hope everybody is doing well today. And we do have two agents here from the Extension office. We have one from the Girard office. Actually, I think you're also from the Girard office as well, Jesse. As we do have one online, though, one on the phone. We have James Coover, and we do have Jesse Gilmore in studio. Guys, good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. It's good to finally be back in studio.
And James, how are you doing today, sir? Yeah, didn't know the studio was. It's all good. It still works that you're both here. So, that way you can still hear each other. So, that's always a good thing. But, it's good to have two guys on at the same time. It's definitely makes it better to actually be able to do that today. And we'll start it off with James today. And James, one of the topics you wanted to talk about, first of all, you want to talk about how dry it is and how the crops are doing. And also, another thing you wanted to bring up today was the potassium deficiency in soybeans.
Depends on what location that you're at. It's been very spotty. The rain has been, which is very normal for June. Some people got lucky and they've gotten a fair amount of rain. Some people have gotten hardly any, hardly over an inch since the beginning of June. And so there are some places that are doing much worse than others. But for the most part, the crops are a little bit drier than usual, and that can lead to some problems. One problem that I'm seeing quite a bit of is actually potassium deficiency. And it's kind of odd that you see a certain nutrient deficiencies when during drought, because you think, if plants aren't growing, they're not using nutrients, so you wouldn't see it. However, potassium, the way that it works, you're actually more likely to see it in a drought situation. And so potassium deficiency, I've seen it a number of fields around the district. And really, at this specific stage in soybeans, is the most likely time to see this issue. Basically, when they're young, they have a few leaves, but they're not quite bushed out yet, and the root systems aren't very big. And so, southeast Kansas is not really naturally high in potassium. We pretty much have the oldest rock, we have the oldest soils, and our parent material of our rocks just don't have potassium in it like the rest of Kansas. And so, but potassium is responsible for a number of plant processes. It's not actually included into the plant itself. It's kind of odd in the way that it works. But it is responsible for a whole lot of enzymes, and that one of those things actually includes water regulation. And so potassium is inside the cell itself, in that cellular gradient of potassium inside the cell is actually what opens and closes the leaf stomata. And so the stoma is it's a tiny little cellular, like a mouth almost, on the leaves that transpire the water and the oxygen, and it brings in the carbon dioxide. So it's always moving things back and forth. But when the stomas aren't working well and the plant isn't getting enough potassium, then the plant can't bring in the water, and it can't bring in the water through the roots. And the issue with that is that potassium is brought in through the roots by water. So dry weather means less potassium, but also it means less potassium water regulation. And so it's sort of a compounding effect, which is why we often see it during drought. Potassium deficiency, of course, is more likely in soils that are deficient in potassium. I mean, usually ones that have high agronomic potassium, so you're much less likely to see it, but it increases the likelihood in dry weather. And so also potassium, like most soil nutrients, are regulated by soil pH, and acidic soils, which is another thing common in southeast Kansas, it makes the potassium deficiencies more likely. In Montgomery, where the studio is, there is some higher native background potassium soils, like the Flint Hills area. There's some lower native background, like the floodplains. And so it really, there's a lot of variability in the soil, especially within the southeast. So deficiencies are more likely to have a history of haying because hay takes a lot of potassium out of the soil. I mean, grain crops take around 60 pounds of potassium. Hay can take anywhere from 150 to 200 pounds of potassium per acre every year. So it takes a lot, and often not, depending on the history of the field, potassium levels are going to be decreasing over time. So one of the symptoms of potassium deficiency is yellowing on the leaf edges. And really that's universal across plant species. There's yellowing along the leaf edges. The leaf veins will tend to stay green, and this will be worse on the older leaves because potassium is very transient within the plant, so it will always be moving it to the newer leaves. And so the older leaves will have this symptom. The leaf edges can become neurotic and kind of start to die off when it gets really bad. And so symptomatic plants, they can be right next to non-symptomatic plants in the field. Some plants will have hidden hunger issues is kind of what we call it, where they're deficient in potassium, but they're not really showing symptoms yet. They can be right next to a plant that is showing symptoms. And it's not always even throughout a field because potassium levels aren't even throughout a field, and neither is pH. And so usually affected plants are smaller. There's a tinge of yellow that you can kind of see throughout the field. And so the same symptoms are true on corn as well, the yellowing of the leaf edges and all that. But corn right now, it's kind of farther along, so we're less likely to see it, except for the very late planted corn. There's still some possibility. So, you know, really, there's a lot of this going on, but there's not really anything we can do about it right now. Foliar application research has shown that there's not a whole lot of yield response to these potassium applications, and potassium is a salt, so we can't put a whole lot of it on foliar applications anyway. And so soybeans, they can recover as the season goes on if we get some rain. We need some rain, and the potassium will be able to get into the roots, and those crops will improve, and those soybeans will fill out, and they'll actually grow out of that potassium deficiency. But there isn't a whole lot we can do for it now, but we need to make sure that the symptoms are being seen and the correct response is being taken.
Yeah, and we haven't been getting a whole lot of rain, at least in this area, for a bit. I know we got some earlier this week, but it's still not a whole lot. We've been had really kind of a dry stretch, which is really not good, especially for those soybeans that need quite a bit of moisture, do they not?
Yeah, they need quite a bit. And, you know, getting a little bit of rain here and there is another thing that kind of increases potassium deficiency, because the soybeans are they're taking that in, they're growing a little bit, but then they still can't quite get that rush of nutrients into the roots. And so and also if it's just trying to pull water from the deeper in the profile where there's not as much potassium. So, you know, yeah, really it's just the lack of water that's making this. So.
Yeah, we definitely need to get that water in because it's, like I said, I want some rain for crying out loud, just to have some rain.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
I do know there was like, and it didn't show up on the Coffeyville meter, but we got some rain over my place like on Sunday that just was coming down to buckets. And then I came to work the next day and it said on that we had no rain in Coffeyville. So it must not been any rain on where the meter is,
yeah,
but it poured at my house.
That was very temperamental. So I live here in Parsons, the town itself it almost seemed like an inch of rain,
mm-hmm.
But the research center, K-State Extension Research Center, which is on the north side of town, didn't get a single drop.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, I mean, that's like less than half a mile away.
so basically, Parsons shows up as no rain. So and so that's basically the same thing that happened to my place. All right. A few more things we can discuss with. We are talking to James Coover and Jesse Gilmore from the K-State Extension offices. We appreciate them being in. Another thing you wanted to talk about today, James, was testing well water.
Yes. So, are we going to talk about that now? Or
Yeah. We have plenty of time to talk about it. It's only 7:50, so we still have plenty of time.
Sounds good. And so, I thought the other thing we could kind of talk about is a little bit farther away from the agronomic side of things, more general topic of testing water wells. And so, Jesse can actually probably talk a little bit about testing water wells for horticultural irrigation. But what I want to talk a little bit today was about testing water wells for household use. Most people in Southeast Kansas on municipal water, we don't really have a whole lot of water wells around here. But there are still plenty of people out in the country that get their water from well. It's perfectly acceptable. It's fine to use. But there are some things we need to monitor. And so if the water is being used for household use, it needs to be tested well and make sure that it's safe, and it needs to have an airtight cap that's specifically made for wells. And so really it's the air infiltration into these wells that can become an issue, because coliform bacteria, E. coli, all the other kind of dangerous things, they somewhat feed on that oxygen. They don't live well in anaerobic environments. And so having that airtight cap and having that tested well is kind of important, because even though you're not getting sick on a daily basis, you never quite know, like, what's your bacterial load that you're getting from your house water when you have a well. And so the placement of the well is also rather important. You want a well that runoff from the surface isn't getting into. And I've seen some pretty poorly placed wells. I've seen a well actually in the middle of a horse lot, and every time it rained, all the water from the horse lot ran into the well.
Oh.
So, yeah, it was a really bad situation.
But
we got that well fixed up. We got it covered and capped and raised. So, not quite right. I mean, it needs to be in a better location, but at least we got it somewhat fixed. So,
that's not good.
yeah. And you could smell the water.
Oh.
It was not good. So, I mean,
Jesse's over here making faces like, oh, that's disgusting.
Yeah. I could continue on with how bad that story was, but not for radio. It was not a good situation. So if you do get your water from a well, if it's used for more than just outside purposes, if it's used inside the house, now's a good time to get tested. And you can come into the extension offices. We have testing kits that you can take. You fill it out in a certain way, and you'll mail it off and get the results. And so it's fairly easy to do. And while you're doing it, actually, you can test your house for radon, too. And so radon, I don't know a lot about the radon as much as the other, but radon, it's a gas from the decay of organics. It's less common in Southeast Kansas, but we still have plenty of it around here. And so that gas that seeps into basements and under house, it is kind of a carcinogenic risk over time. So while you're testing your water well, you might as well test for your radon, too.
Absolutely. And to get a test for radon, how can folks do that? Can they? Is there test that can be purchased? Is there a way that called the K-State Extension Office to help out with that?
Yeah. So both of these tests, they can be acquired at any Kansas Extension Office. You just come into the offices. We'll give you the kits. You'll do the kits at your house, and then you'll mail them off to whatever company it is that does that testing. And so, but the first step, just come into the extension offices and grab the kits is really the first step.
All right. So sounds good. Be sure to test for those things as well. And also, we were talking about the potassium deficiency. Just like you said, in Southeast Kansas doesn't really have, it's not naturally high in potassium due to, the parent mineral rocks and also being the oldest soils. So it's interesting how this part of Kansas is so much different than, say, even the western part of Kansas. It's almost like there's a line right down the middle of the state where one half is something, one thing, and one half is the other.
Yeah, it really is. If you look at geological maps, it's a really distinct line with the Flint Hills. So, yeah.
it's the same way in Oklahoma as well. It's like Oklahoma City is the dividing line from, like, desert to woods. It's pretty interesting to see, like you said, looking at the geological map. All right, we are going to talk to – in fact, I'll just bring Jesse in here for just a moment, and we can kind of preview what we're going to talk about the next segment. Jesse, it's been a while since we've seen you, so welcome back into the studio, sir. And what are we going to discuss today? I know last time you were here, you were on there, you talked about Dutch elm disease. Can you kind of just give us a preview preview what we're going to talk about in the next segment.
Yeah, so we're going to go back a little bit over Dutch Elm disease again, because I've had more cases flare up in the last couple of weeks, and it's important to understand Dutch Elm disease in the landscape. And that's kind of going to segue into varying landscape trees for homeowners throughout southeastern Kansas and the rest of the listening area. Kind of give some trees that could stand to be planted more often in the area because they do well in our conditions, and you don't really see them a lot in the landscape. Whereas if you know, maples, you see those everywhere. Everyone's got at least one.
Right.
Sweet gums and oaks, those are also commonly planted. So varying trees in the landscape or in, you know, any planting you make is going to decrease the chance that you lose large swaths of trees to diseases like Dutch Elm disease. So we're going to go into that a little bit after the break.
All right. Sounds good. So we're going to go ahead and take the break. And James, if you want to hang on to the line, you can. And we'll go ahead and take this break. When we come back, we will have news at the top of the hour. And then we'll get started back up with Greenside Up at around 8:10. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day. Welcome back to Greenside Up right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF on this hump day. I hope everybody is doing well today. And back in studio with us is Jesse Gilmore. And also on the line with us is James Coover. And welcome back. And Jesse, we're going to start with you on this part. And, you know, you kind of previewed it before we went to the break. You were going to talk about kind of piggybacking last time. You talked about Dutch Elm disease when you're here. You kind of want to piggyback on that, because there have been a lot of cases.
Yes, there have, and it's really unfortunate to see, because elm trees are very good shade trees, which is why they're planted so frequently around the area, especially in Pittsburgh and the Crawford County area. You see elm trees just lining the streets, and Dutch elm disease is so damaging because once the tree has it, it's pretty much terminal, and you won't be able to save the tree. There are some things you can try, but they haven't been shown to be effective. Varying your tree plantings in the landscape is incredibly important to make sure that you don't just completely lose all of the trees on your property. Even in smaller properties, having an assortment of tree species will help kind of give your landscape a more varied look throughout the growing season, and also kind of shield you from any potential disease problems that one species might have, like Dutch elm disease, for example.
And you said it's been, you know, that you've seen a lot of they've jumped within the past couple of weeks. How does it get from tree to tree? We were talking about a few of those things off the air. And one of the things that you're saying is beetles is actually a big transmitter of Dutch elm disease.
Yep, that is the primary way that Dutch elm disease is transmitted. There is a species of beetle called the elm bark beetle, which basically tunnels underneath the elm bark to overwinter, and then it emerges, and new hatchlings or new larvae of the bark beetle will go up to weak parts of the tree canopy to feed on particular branches, and it carries the fungus that causes the wilt disease in the tree in its gut. And so when it feeds on these branches of the tree, it transmits the fungus from where it got it, usually another infected elm tree in the area. And so you see it move slowly inward towards the center of the country from both coasts, essentially, mm-hmm. Taking out over 40 million elm trees since its introduction.
And you said it's kind of exploded in the area. And then another way is that you cannot see sometimes is if the roots can actually transmit from if the trees are close enough.
Yeah, if the roots grow together, it's what's known as grafting or fusing. They have to be somewhat close, usually within 50 feet of each other, but the disease can also be transmitted that way as well. And the symptoms that you'll see if the disease is transmitted through root grafts will be slightly different the symptoms will be slightly different from what you would see if it was transmitted by bark beetles. So because the bark beetles go up to the canopy and feed on weak limbs, you'll see the wilting of random branches throughout the canopy, whereas if it transmits through root grafts, you're going to see the lowest branches in the canopy start wilting first, while the upper branches are still fine.
Right, so it'll just kind of work its way up the tree from the bottom, since it is starting at the bottom, and it just will work its way up that way.
Yep.
So it's definitely not a good thing, and like I say, it's been just disastrous, killing 40 million elms. It's hard to stop these things, especially beetles, but what is there a way to kind of prevent that from happening?
So scouting is essential to ensure that you catch the disease early. If you catch the disease early, there are things you can try. Usually it involves pruning out infected branches about 10 feet below where the streaking of the wood inside the branch stops. That is one way to keep the disease from moving inward towards the center of the tree. However, this has not really been shown to be all that effective. You can also inject fungicides into the base of the tree for transmission throughout the tree through its vascular tissue. That will get very expensive very quickly. Mm-hmm. And usually, if more than 10% of the canopy in the tree is affected by Dutch elm disease, and it's confirmed to be Dutch elm disease, the tree will die at some point from the disease. There's nothing you can really do to save it. So at that point, it would probably be best if you remove the tree as soon as possible and got started on planting a new tree. Either a variety of elm that is resistant to Dutch elm disease, like the Siberian elm, the lacebark elm, or certain cultivars of the American elm. Princeton is, I think, the most common one. Or plant a different species of tree that is also suited to our climate, that is more disease resistant and has fewer problems attached to it.
So you're saying, plant a different tree. What is the is it the American elm that's the one that's most affected by the Dutch elm disease?
Yes, because Dutch elm disease was introduced from Eastern Europe and Western Asia. It's affecting native elms, but not the elms that originated from that environment, because those trees are more adapted to dealing with the disease, whereas the American elm had no defenses for the fungus, which is why it was so devastating to Native American elm populations.
And that's why it worked away from the coasts into the country, because obviously since it came over from there, it started on the coast and worked its way to the middle of the country, which is where it's here now. So,
yep.
Which means it's pretty widespread now around the country. So different types of elms that you can plant. And you said you can still plant some American elms. But with different cultivars. Well, for maybe somebody like me who I'm not that smart about trees. So, what is a cultivar, and how does that apply to the tree?
So, a cultivar is a particular line, a generational line of trees that have been selected for certain characteristics. In the case of Princeton, it's selected for its resistance to Dutch elm disease. So they kept breeding these trees to have increased resistance, until the point where they said, this has enough resistance to the point where this tree is marketable for this trait. We're now going to vegetatively propagate it so that it will always have this characteristic for any child plant that we take cuttings from. Usually it's wood cuttings.
Mm-hmm.
And then you propagate them, you have a new tree, you sell that, you keep taking cuttings from parent plants and then selling those. And they're always guaranteed to have that particular trait because they're not being pollinated and propagated through seed. If they were open pollinated, then the characteristic that you want would not be guaranteed to be in the child plant, because you have genes from multiple sources coming into the child plant and basically introducing variability, whereas with vegetative cuttings, it's essentially a clone of the parent.
Okay, so they're able to kind of basically get a disease-resistant version of the American elm. So, again, Dutch elm disease, not a good thing, kind of just going around the country big time. Hopefully we can get those American elms that are resistant to it to start sprouting up, start getting those planted around the country to help that. Another thing that you we discussed just a little bit, but not we didn't go in depth into it, was a scorch leaf. I do believe is what you were saying. And what is that? And just kind of explain that to us.
Yeah. So James mentioned before the break that leaves have these little pores called stomata on the bottom. This is how the oxygen that is produced during respiration for the leaves is released. But the problem with that is that water is often released from those pores as well. Essentially, it functions a lot in the same way as people sweating, where water evaporates off of us and cools us off. But for trees, hot and windy weather is a very big problem because the wind will carry the evaporated water, the humid air, that is supposed to keep water loss from increasing and continuing faster than it can be replaced. It will carry that humid air away from the surface of the leaf, and water will continue to evaporate out of the leaf faster than it can be replaced. And essentially what will happen is it will desiccate the leaf. And usually you will either see that on the edges of the leaf or on the tip of the leaf, and depending on what trees you see it in. We've seen it a lot in maples and in ornamental pears right now. With the rains we got last week in Pittsburgh anyway, obviously, variable rains.
Right.
But with the rains we got in Pittsburgh, you'll see it slow down. But a lot of people have been calling me worried that, oh my gosh, is this a disease? And because 90-ish percent of plant diseases are going to be caused by fungi, you will very rarely see disease pop up in hot, dry weather that we've been having. You would more likely see that in cooler, wetter weather.
Right. And you're saying, like James was talking about, the stomata. Basically, like you said, it works like a human, except it works the other direction. When it gets moisture on it, it brings it into the leaf, correct?
Not quite.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry,
help explain that so I can kind of understand it. So.
Yeah. So, for people, it's the evaporating off of the skin that carries heat with it. So, it's the evaporation that cools you down.
Right.
In humid weather, for people, you can't get that evaporation, and so you can't stay cool. You want sweat to evaporate off of your skin.
Right, right.
For trees, they don't want the water evaporating out of their leaves. And so
they want it on it or in it.
In it, yes. So the humidity that kind of hovers around the leaf as water evaporates out of the pores is supposed to slow down water loss because the water can't evaporate into humid air as easily.
Right.
But because the wind is blowing the humid air away, the dry air makes it so much easier for more water to evaporate out, and it's being continually carried away. So it's
drying the leaf out, basically, what it's doing.
Right. Whereas people would not want humidity to stay cool. In order to stay cool in heat, trees do want humidity in order to save water.
Right. So it's different. We don't like humidity because it makes it just feel really heavy out there, but trees need that humidity to basically help them slow out that water loss. So, so even if the humidity's high and we don't like it, that's still good for the trees, though, correct?
Yes, and people are very distressed by marginal leaf scorch. It looks very bad, but as is the case with most foliar diseases and disorders, it's not going to harm the long-term health of the tree. Usually, if you can, keep it isolated to one or two instances of the problem. If you start getting it year after year after year, mm-hmm. that can put a lot of stress on the tree. But in mature trees, it's not going to cause long-term issues. In new plantings, it's going to be a lot more important to provide supplemental water because the summer is when it's building a lot of its energy reserves that it needs to basically get through the winter healthily.
Mm-hmm.
And for fruit trees in particular, they need constant water in order to set and ripen fruit. So marginal leaf scorch in peaches, plums, apples, things like that, that's going to be detrimental to any potential yield you could get. So supplemental watering for new and fruit trees are going to be more important than any mature trees that might have marginal leaf scorch.
So be on the lookout for that. And you said what is the kind of look at that? If you look at it, it can kind of look like it's a disease or some fungal, and that can kind of distress some people to thinking, oh my gosh, my tree may be sick. And it may not necessarily be that, correct?
Right. Yeah. You're going to look for desiccation on the edges or on the tips of leaves. For ornamental pears, it's going to be on the edges of the leaf, and for maples, it's going to be on about the outer third of the leaf, and the symptoms can kind of vary.
Right. All right. Well, James, are you still there? Okay, I didn't hear from you. So, James, again, you were talking earlier about soybeans, and if anybody has any questions, or maybe are you guys still going out and performing tests as of right now by appointment for testing several different things? I remember talking to David a few weeks ago that you're still doing some things, but only by appointment right now. Correct.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, anybody can call us. I mean, me, Jesse, Dave, and Wendy, we're all going out and doing house visits, farm visits, whatever it is that people need. And of course, they're welcome to the extension office to grab things. Mm-hmm. If you're going to the extension office, give us a call first so we can plan for you, because sometimes the doors are locked.
Right.
And that's really it. And so honestly, at the inside of the office, just give us a call, even if you're just standing right outside of the door, honestly.
All right.
We're definitely open. We're definitely still running around doing everything that people need us to do. So.
And if they do want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
For me, they can call the Girard office or my cell phone, because usually I'm running around. The Girard office is 620-724-8233, but my cell phone number is 620-778-1037.
And Jesse, if anybody wants to get a hold of you about what you've been talking about today, how can they get a hold of you?
For me, they can also call the Girard office, 620-724-8233. I personally do better with email, though.
Mm-hmm.
My email address is jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. So, guys, I thank you so much for calling in and coming in today. And we will see you guys pretty soon. And, again, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we are going to start Open Line. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF on this hump day.